99% of the job for us. The next great breakthrough in technology is going to be in biological engineering. Of course, we've used animals for hundreds, thousands of years as extensions of our personalities and our bodies. The sheepdog, senile dog, very remarkable examples. Although the most remarkable example of all is one that no living man has ever seen, and that was the war elephant, which had to understand and obey several hundred words of command on the battlefield. If it didn't, it wasn't much good as a war elephant. The Egyptians, you know, it's a scandal that we have domesticated no new animals since the Stone Age. The Egyptians had baboons waiting on table. Of course, you've all been in restaurants where you suspect that. I'm sure that if within a few decades we could, with the help of genetics and Professor Skinner, could develop a creature based on the chimpanzee with a tenfold improvement in intelligence, vocabulary, and disposition. Kind of domesticated ape. When it comes on the labor market, the servant shortage will be over, and the housewife of 2001 need no longer be envious of her great-great-grandmother of 1901, until, of course, they start to form their own unions. You may object to this point, if you haven't already, that the main result of all these developments will be to eliminate 99% of human activity and to leave your descendants faced with a future of utter boredom, where the main problem in life is that deciding which of the several thousand TV channels to tune to. This is perfectly true if we look at humanity as it is constituted today. H.G. Wells once said that future history will be a race between education and catastrophe. I was talking to Wells about a month ago. I had the extraordinary experience of seeing all H.G. Wells' personal first editions of his books annotated in his own handwriting. They're all up at the Boston University Library. I had no idea there was such a collection in the Yougar Memorial Library, which is ultimately going to have my papers as well as Isaac Asimov's. It already has a room full of Isaac Asimov. A race between education and catastrophe. I doubt if even Wells realized the educational standards that will have to be attained to cope with the problem of universal leisure. For while, ironically enough, we hear so much talk nowadays about full employment, and indeed we need it, what we're ultimately heading for is the exact reverse, full unemployment. Thus, there's no function today for manual laborers, and there'll be none tomorrow for those of only clerical and executive skills. So the day after tomorrow, society will have no place for anyone as ignorant as the average mid-20th century college graduate. If anyone here I have not offended, I apologize. Who is lost and helpless as one of those highly educated men the Pilgrim Fathers dumped in Times Square during the rush hour. Now, it seems an impossible goal to bring the whole population of the planet up to super university levels. Remember that a couple of centuries ago, it seemed unthinkable that one day everybody would have to be able to read and write. As an example of the way in which educational standards have improved slightly, during the Middle Ages, if an English boy wanted to learn arithmetic, Oxford or Cambridge could cope if he was content to go no higher than addition and subtraction. If he wanted to learn multiplication and division, he had to go to Europe. Well, we have made some progress, and I'm sure we'll make much more. The development of teaching machines, I think, shows great promise. I'm sure that many of you have heard that remark, that any teacher who can be replaced by a machine should be. Investigation is the way in which the brain stores information. Perhaps one day we'll find out how our cells work and how we do collect and sort information. Perhaps we may be able to stamp out knowledge on the brain the way you stamp out a symphony on a gramophone record, in a sort of instant French. These hint at the new and revolutionary weapons we've got to use in the war against ignorance. The greatest single industry of the future will be education. The second greatest will be entertainment. I think the two should be synonymous. For every man, education will have to be a process which continues throughout life. We've got to abandon, as swiftly as possible, the idea that schooling is something restricted to youth. How can it be, in a world where half of things a man knows at 20 are no longer true at 40, and half the things he knows at 40 hadn't even been discovered when he was 20? If I had to sum up the main social problem of the future in one sentence, it's going to be that of raising the school leaving age to approximately 120. So perhaps the greatest change at the turn of the millennium will have to be in the mental attitudes required then, rather than the physical backgrounds of our lives, although of course those too will change profoundly. We have to develop a flexibility of mind, a capacity for organizing knowledge, and an active curiosity about the universe, which will make us seem almost a new species. Anyone who's ever had the stimulating and rather shattering experience of meeting a really educated man will know precisely what I mean. I've been very lucky. I've met an educated man twice in my life. In the race against catastrophe of which H.G. Wells warned us so long ago, the last lap has already begun. If we lose it, the world of 2000 will be much like ours, with its problems and evils and vices enlarged, perhaps beyond endurance. But if we win, 2001 could mark the great divide between barbarism and civilization. It is inspiring to realize that, with some luck and much hard work, we have a chance of living to see the final end of the Dark Ages. Thank you.
There will be a question and answer period right now for about 15 minutes, and then a reception will be held until about 3:15. Thank you.
Well, if when you sort yourselves out, you just sort of put a few minutes to let people get away who have to. In fact, any of you who want to ask questions might move down near the front so I can hear you and have a closer interaction. Will you stand up and I'll repeat the question so you can all hear what it was.
The Russian performances that we have only 20 years with the same direction which to turn the technology around for it to be done. Do you agree that we have only that marginal amount of time?
I would say that in some areas we have less than 20 years. In others we may have some rather more, but I think that's a pretty fair figure. The self-contained home, how will you manage that thing? It's like toothpaste, toilet paper, and clothes, and so forth. That's a very good question. They better ask Lucky Fuller. I'm sure he has the answers. I haven't worked it out in detail. Obviously, you couldn't have a completely self-contained home. There would be a lot of inefficiencies and waste. Obviously, you'd have to top up water and chemicals and many things. And there would be many things you would have to get from outside. Ultimately, this is looking maybe several hundred years ahead. This is pure science fiction. There is this device called a replicator, which can reproduce literally anything from a given matrix. I discussed this in Profiles of the Future. It seems magic to us, but I like to mention Clark's third law, which says that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. The idea is, you have a machine which can reassemble any material according to the pattern which is stored in its memory. So you can, if you want to make 20-carat diamonds or cordon bleu steak or whatever, you can just dial the right number. Now this is centuries ahead, if indeed it is ever possible. I don't know what the short-term solutions are. The two educated men I met, they're both dead, so there probably aren't any educated men now, except my friend Isaac, who I mentioned earlier. One was the biologist geneticist J.B.S. Haldane, and the other was the philosopher and science fiction writer Olaf Stapledon. I refer you to the Whole Earth catalog for Olaf. B.F. Skinner's proposals, I presume you read them too. I've not read his new book. I just do not know enough about it to comment. But I feel an instinctive repugnance, which may not be a valid criticism. Really the question is, unemployment, the cost of, how do we get from here to there? That's probably what you're driving at, isn't it? What the governments do, I have no idea, because governments, I think, are largely arbitrary and random. I don't believe there is a necessarily best form of government, but I think any form of government can be made to work fairly well. It depends entirely on the people, on their morality and their humanity. I don't even believe that democracy is necessarily the best, but I'm sure that democracy isn't the best form of government at some stages of society. I see this all the time in the East. So I'm not hung up on any particular form of government. I live in a country which has in its cabinet one Marxist Russian type, one Trotskyite, working fairly well together. I know them both, I'm a good friend with them. And we just had a rebellion from the extreme communists against the government. So you see, I have a rather wider view of the way in which governments might or should or shouldn't work. I'm not even against the Republicans. Oh, someone was suffering from claustrophobia by being confined to the solar system. I'm very interested in this too, of course. I'm sure they get outside the solar system. The main problem of interstellar travel is perhaps not a technical problem, not an engineering problem, but a biological problem. No intelligent species dies at the age of 80 years. Life extension may solve this problem. Deep freezing, suspended animation. There are lots of technological solutions to the problem of interstellar flight. The multi-generation space arc, all these things. Getting up to near the speed of light so that time slows down. And it is no longer totally inconceivable that time itself may not be the ultimate barrier. In the last few years, some physicists have come up with some very interesting theories, pointed out that even the theory of relativity does not prohibit going faster than light. It merely says you cannot travel at the speed of light, which is a subtle distinction. Is it going to be illegal to own a car? There are a lot of cars right now that it should be illegal to own. Yes, in the city, of course. Not elsewhere. It may be illegal to drive a car manually on the highways. I'm sure that's going to come. They'll have to have automatic guidance on the main highways. It'll be illegal to have a car in the city. I mean, this is already true in many cities. I mean, we're building some cities in England that have a continuous figure-eight bus service non-stop around the central, and only pedestrians allowed, and the buses travel, and since there's no other vehicles on the road, the buses can go very fast, very safely. And there are many types of internal city transportation which must got to be developed. And, of course, other forms of public transportation. I mean, the transportation system in this country is an absolute scandal. I mean, we know that. Economically and, all right, yeah?
In the future, do you think any of the accomplishments you have made through physical inventions can be eliminated by, biological science, that is, can we change that?
Can we change now? We can and will. I mean, man is always changing psychologically, socially. I don't draw any distinction between biological invention and, you might say, mechanical or electronic invention. It's all part of a continuous spectrum.
It's hard to put. I was thinking like the dinosaurs were on this planet were many more centuries than man. And that is just how the bolt is in the air. Not by simply inventing a plane from ships,
but by children. Well, biological evolution, of course, got us where we are. But it's limited, and the trouble is that eventually you tend to specialize, and when as soon as you specialize, you're doomed. We have got where we are because we haven't specialized. We can do almost anything, not as well as something. We can do anything we can do better than we can do, but there's nothing that can do everything that we can do as well as we can do. And the dinosaurs specialized on armor, for example, and that was the end of them. And some specialized on flight. I'm sure the pterodactyls and pteranodons are pretty lousy flyers, but they did fly. Of course, you have raised an interesting point here. Whether or not intelligence has any survival value, this is what we've perhaps specialized in. When you look at our planet, the most successful creatures seem to be those with the least intelligence, the sharks, the insects. See the Hellstorm Chronicle if you want to make some thoughts on that. So it may be that intelligence is a biological aberration that dooms its possessors the way the armor dooms the dinosaurs. Looking at the Daily Newspaper, you can make a very good case for that. So this is, incidentally, one of the reasons why the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is so important. It will give us some confidence if we find it. But intelligence doesn't necessarily mean that you've had it. My comment on UFOs, I have a chapter on this in the new book of essays called Things in the Sky. It's a very complicated situation. I've been interested in this for 30 years. I've seen about 8 UFOs, and some of them would have been completely convincing to the layman. And in every case, I was able to find what they were. In some cases, it took me a long time and a lot of trouble. So having been through this process myself, I am therefore 99% skeptical. I'm not even interested in the description of the UFO because nothing you can do about it when you know, there's no way you can check up on anything. So all these, I'm more than 99% sure that all these reports are mistakes, hoaxes, etc., etc. However, there is a small body, a very small group of sightings, some of which have been tracked by multiple radars, also believe, which the public doesn't know much about, incidentally. There are some are mentioned in the Condon report, which are quite inexplicable, if true. And so we should continue keeping an eye on this. My private theory is that there may be some unknown natural phenomenon, which may be quite interesting and may be trivial. I am 99.999% sure they're not visitors from space, for many reasons. The radars around this Earth are tracking everything bigger than a counting pen within 1,000 miles of Earth. This couldn't have been going on if the radio were visitors from space all this time without us being absolutely sure that I think that a real visitor from space would be spotted in about 15 minutes flat. And of course, I don't rule out the possibility that there have been visitors from space many times in the past, the remote past, because this is one of the themes of 2001. It's quite a can of worms. Citizenship, ownership, voting rights. Well, we could vote worldwide, obviously, but I see no particular problems greater, and certainly there wouldn't be any less, than those that this country had to face and solve. Well, I know it's just trying to solve many of them. You know, when you formed the United States, suddenly another next quantum jump. Some sort of, and the world can learn, and will, I hope, learn from what happened here. My scenario for the future, the way this will happen, which I don't take too seriously, but which I like to tell you, is that during the next 50 years or so, we're going to see the rise of international consortiums and organizations become so powerful, so essential, that everybody will join them. Now, we already have the most important one was formed this summer, Intelsat, the world organization of nearly 18 countries, many of them hitting each other's guts, which run the International Communications Satellite Consortium, of which COMSAT is the American member. I was present at the signing of the treaty in the State Department. In fact, I addressed the delegates after the treaty, and I told them then that what they just signed was the first draft of the United States of Earth. I think these organizations, the World Weather Watch, the World Health Organization, the International Organization of Airline Pilots, these things are getting more and more powerful, more and more essential. And I suspect in about, round about the end of the century, they will discover to their great surprise and even consternation that they're really running the world. They are the world state, and that the national states, sovereign states, will slowly lose their powers and become much like the states of this country. That's one way it might happen. Will we lose the sort of really poetic messages, the feeling about people like Blake, that we don't know where we're going? Well, of course, we perhaps do know where we're going. But I put against Blake's feelings the feelings of Tennyson and Shelley about the same thing. Whether those are messages from the unconscious, what the role of art is going to be in the world of the future, I don't know. You can make a very good case of saying that art in a perfect world would be unnecessary. Art may be a compensation for the defects of the real world. It's a very plausible argument. The wound and the bow thesis. It may be true, I don't know. I rather hope it isn't, though. I hope that art will always exist in its own right. Time for perhaps a couple more questions. What started the great upsurge of technology? I don't. It's a very interesting question. The man you ought to ask, of course, is Joseph Needham. Why didn't the Chinese do what get where we are? Is there a particular reason? Is it just pure chance that the West, was it just because there was coal and a cheap source of fuel and energy? I just don't know. And there may be no reason. It may just be chance. But on the other hand, there may be a reason. I'm sure that many of these questions about the laws of society, we won't begin to get an answer to them until we've studied other societies, and we won't do that perhaps for 1,000 years until we've seen quite a few other societies. At the moment, of course, we have only 2 or 3 societies on this earth to study. One human, of course, is the only one we know much about. Will people be able to understand the science and technology? Of course, this is the concept of future shock, which Arvind Toffler has developed. Incidentally, Alden and Bucky Fuller and I did a 3-way discussion on CBS TV, for Camera 3, some time ago. I don't know if it's gone out on the air yet, but you might look out for it. It was quite a swinging party. I don't know whether we can cope, and one of the reasons why I give these talks, now I only give them to college groups, is because I hope that I'm improving slightly the probability of being able to cope. But I am still an optimist. I think we have a 51% chance of survival.
Uh,
A month ago, Dr. Renee DeBose was here, and one of the things he talked about was the fact that we've been doubling the consumption of electrical energy here in the United States. We've got a worldwide trend, at least wanted to do what we did. We spoke about this as confronting us with a very busy problem of thermal pollution, and by thermal pollution, again, not really the pollution of the water, the any reservoir that we might try to use. And you talk about, well, biological engineering, but you also talk about growth of I know that much of our energy is used to heat our homes and so forth. And I wonder if you can comment on this, on your feeling about how this all we can prevent the solve the problems of thermal pollution.
Yes, we are going to increase our power consumption. We do seem to double it every 5 years or so. It's at a tremendous rate. And those obviously cannot continue indefinitely, and particularly as the so-called developing countries insist on doing the same thing. And we are in no position to say, well, we've done this. We have a high energy civilization that you mustn't have for the good of the world. But we're obviously that's an immoral and impossible situation. We're going to switch to fusion power, of course, sometime in the next lifetime. We're going to I hope use the power we've got much more efficiently, but we're up against this inevitable problem, thermal pollution, which is already very serious around some power stations in local areas. And when you continue the curve, you find in a very short period of time, a trivial period of time, 100 to 200 years, which is nothing, the Earth becomes red hot. So obviously somewhere we've got to, and the answer actually I think is quite simple. We've got to tap the sun. We can't tap the sun here on Earth. It's too dilute. You need about a square yard to collect one horsepower. Of course, it's very valuable for space probes that have, whereas in sunlight continuously and don't need much power. We will start to tap the sun when we really need it, 50 or 100 years from now, going in close. So inverse square law is in our favor, going perhaps into Mercury or much closer still. And then we'll essentially have all the power we need, and we can worry about thermal pollution there. And our heavy industries will be out in space. This is another reason, in the long-term view, why we've got to get into space, because space is an infinite heat sink and can absorb all the thermal pollution we are likely to generate. Well, I think we have to go to the reception now. Thank you very much. I enjoyed speaking to you.
The reception is in just a few slides. There will be refreshments. Thank you.